At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 114 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine that attempts to answer that age-old question. What is it that draws people to this, the most unique of all games? Rod Murray's my name, and on this episode, my colleague John Huggins sat down with a golfer who at one time looked to be a can't-miss prospect, but whose career ended up taking a different path. Nick Doherty was one of England's most promising amateurs in the late 1990s, and after turning pro in 2001, enjoyed a successful, if turbulent, career. Three wins between 2005 and 2009 were a highlight, but away from the course, injury and the sudden death of his mother in 2008 took their toll. Doherty officially announced his retirement from playing in 2016 and has since gone on to establish himself as a respected commentator on the game with Sky Sports in the UK. Like all golfers, Doherty's journey is one full of twists and turns, and it's a story that I hope you enjoy hearing as much as I did.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time around is one of golf's best talkers. I think I can describe him as that. Anyone who's watched Sky Sports will be familiar with Nick Doherty. So the first question is always the same, Nick. What was and is the thing about golf for you?
The thing about golf is that it's a metaphor for everything that happens in life. And I've got to know that more and more as I've got older. At first, when you're a kid, it's easy. You can only see good things happening as happens in life, right? It's all fun and games, isn't it? And then you get older and things go wrong and things problems happen. Arise and then voices are in the mind telling you certain things and doubts and failures. And that's true of golf and it's true of life. And arguably, you know, I've had a few bumps in the road in my life as well. I think golf has probably prepared me for it, but also been a massive bump in the road itself as well. So for me, it's a metaphor for life.
Yeah, you've kind of briefly summarized your career there because I've made a couple of notes here and you were, you know, for a long time, you were on a pretty strong upward trajectory. I mean, you were ticking them off, you Nick Faldo Jr. tournament, Walker Cup, Rookie of the Year, win on tour, Sevi Trophy team member, top 10 in a major, and then it left you, it was sadly. Well, yeah, right, okay, I know you and I have talked about this before. I've done, just to interject, I've done a couple of columns with Nick in the past on this subject, so this is not, it's not the best subject, but it's one that I'm sure you're used to by now.
To be honest, it's one that I'm very passionate about because I find it really cathartic talking about it. I think with the job I do now, it's given me a better perspective. So we spend our entire life, especially on TV, covering the best players who are doing the best each given week, right? Because if you're not a good player, unless you're Rory or a Tiger or something like that, we're not really going to see
If you're shooting 74, you're not getting talked to.
So golf's easy. Like you watch on TV, it is really easy. Why isn't it that easy for everybody? And, you know, I think the highs and lows of my career have given me a really good sort of view of the landscape of the game. And I'd say I was bulletproof. That's how I would describe it when I was a kid. Obviously, I lost tournaments, but I was bulletproof. It never, ever crept into my mind. It never got past the armor. And I always thought if I'd lost one, it's because something better was coming. And it sort of self-fulfilling prophecy would arrive and it would sort of work out that way. Or that's how I chose to see it anyway. Right. As I got a little bit older, some of the bumps were more severe, you know, and it was more off course really for me with losing my mum was the biggest one. But it sort of, it was at the same time as when I was actually playing my best golf. So it caused some problems for me because I didn't know how to deal with that. I wasn't equipped. If I could go back and in hindsight, it wouldn't be a wonderful thing.
Well, grief's a funny thing though, isn't it? I mean, everybody's different when in those situations.
But I didn't deal with it. And in fact, I ploughed more pressure onto myself. I made that year, because I was doing well in the Ryder Cup standings at that point, I was top 50 in the world. I just played the Masters for the first time, played nicely. And I was in position going into the last round to have a chance to win at Harbour Town. And that's when I got the phone call. Mum had had the heart attack. 7 days pass and you end up that surreal position of turning off life support and watching your mum pass away in front of you. That's something that happens to lots of people, losing a relative, losing a mother or a father. Hopefully happens to all of us rather than the other way around. But I wasn't prepared for it. I'd never had. I mean, the hardest thing in my life were three putts and doubles. You know, I mean, that really was a sheltered existence, mm-hmm. but arguably why I was bulletproof, which helped as a professional sportsman.
Yeah. A lack of perspective can help.
Yeah. But I had a very new one after losing mum because it was very finite. That is that. They're not coming back ever. And I decided to make it my goal because mum would want me to play in that Ryder Cup team. And I made it very public. I remember speaking to you guys on the Tuesday. I buried her on the Monday. I flew back from the States. We flew mum home. Mm-hmm. We buried her. And then I flew out on the Tuesday to the Italian Open, spoke to you guys the day I got there, and then played. And I still finished top 10.
Yeah.
I was in tears for most of it. I was all over the place, but I was still a good golfer at that stage. Mm. The doubts that I had as a person, though, started to creep into golf. And the pressure I was putting on myself to make that team, and it came down to the back nine of the last tournament, Glen Eagles. Yeah. I had that chance to knock Ollie Wilson out of the team. Yeah. And then Nick was captain, and he pulled me into that room, and for a split second thought he might give me a wild card. And as I opened the door, he said, "I'm not picking you, but come and sit down."
Yeah.
And I think there was this weight of emotion that just fell off me at the end of it. And carrying that did quite a lot of damage, I think. I actually went on to win the next year from nowhere, really, in Germany.
Yeah.
And that was where my career really came to an end.
That, not only was that your last win, that was your last top 10.
Exactly.
Extraordinary, really.
If you're not counting the tie for fourth at the Colombian Masters the next year of the Challenge Tour. No, not
giving you that one.
Okay.
Not giving you that one.
Yeah, and you know, I think, again, I was in this whirlwind of not knowing how to deal with anything. And when I won it in Germany, I did the whole pointy up thing at the sky for mum because I'd seen Martin Keimer do it with his mum, ironically, the year before, because I thought that's what you do. And then that will be it then. Right. Okay. Hard thing in life, but we're back on track, Nick. And it wasn't. It was completely deflating, I'd say, the aftermath. And I thought, this is way too hard as a game to not celebrate the wins. I mean, I played over, 300 and something events. I only won three, which is still good on tour. You know, it's still a decent career. Yeah.
Most golfers are losers most of their career.
And I thought, oh, that's a problem if it feels like this. And I never recovered from it. And the problem I had was, rather than accept where I was, and I'm going back, I wish I'd had a better structure around me in terms of support and someone just to say, whoa, just calm down. Take a minute here. This is big.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I just focused on something that was tangible to me, that was golf. I had a purpose with golf and I just didn't have a reason after that because I thought that's what mum would want me to do to win again. And it actually struck me in that moment that she didn't care. She didn't care.
Yeah.
In essence, I thought, well, if it's not for her, it made me sort of question, who is this for? And that was a really challenging thing for me. And I never really found my way back from it. And instead of trying to deal with what was going on mentally, I just started changing everything. Coaches, caddies, managers.
I remember you doing all that.
Everyone. Yeah. Literally everyone. You're the only one who didn't get a look in, John.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure I would have helped much. Certainly not with the 75-yard wedge shots. Anyway, I did want to really start with that, but you weighed in and we were going to talk about that. But I wanted to go back to the happier stuff.
Yeah.
You know, certainly your amateur career, which climaxed obviously with being in a winning Walker Cup team in America, which is not something that many people can say.
No, that was amazing. We're very lucky. That team was superb.
Yeah.
I think other than Nigel Edwards, who obviously went on to be a captain, who's Great Britain Ireland, and Gary Wilson, who then did turn pro, obviously later in life, we all played on tour at some stage, which is unusual for a whole team.
Yeah.
First time I ever met Luke Donald, that, ironically, because obviously he was in university and we're still at a time where we didn't really cross paths.
Yeah.
He was my roommate and my foursomes partner. I ruined his Walker Cup record. He'd never lost a match until that.
Yeah.
So blame me, obviously. To be fair, he wasn't great from the trees and I wasn't great from 40 yards further back than I was used to playing from.
Yeah.
We won the next day, though, the second foursomes. But that was amazing. Great way to go out. I had a really good amateur career. Obviously, for me, some of the biggest thing, really, obviously winning in Japan, the World Junior was huge, but, you know, winning Nick Faldo's event, was really big for me as a person because he was my hero growing up. Mm-hmm. So I all of a sudden, you know, I got to meet my hero, but he really took me under his wing. And, I spent so much time with him. I mean, it was a dream come true. Mm. And so some great memories, and it was a great way to sign off. And, you know, Luke and I turned pro the next day and we both cruised through the Q School.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Nick Faldo as well back in the day. I was his ghostwriter for years. And I have to say that your memories are significantly better than mine, but that's another story entirely. Let's move on. Actually, the sort of jump to where you are now was hinted at when that Walker Cup team won the Golf Writers Trophy and the award was done at the dinner at the Open. And I remember Peter McAvoy, who was the captain, telling me that he had to pick a member of the team to go up and make the speech. And he picked you. Mm-hmm. He says, I didn't even have to think about it. He says, he's comfortable doing that stuff. Mm. That was a real hint, I think, for everybody to what you're doing now.
Yeah.
So, and you were the youngest member of the team.
Amazingly, so many of the journalists, so obviously, I didn't know that well at the time because it was my first time in front of you guys. Mm. Didn't think I'd written it myself, which was, I suppose, a compliment. Yeah. But I wrote that. Typically, as you do when you were a kid, the night before in the hotel room.
Last minute.
But it was fun. But I remember, one thing I remember is that I had a little pop at the Americans and then I didn't realize till we were there that David Duval was at the dinner. I thought, oh God, this felt better when I thought I was talking to just Europeans or to British people. But that was amazing. It was a great honor to be bestowed upon me and to do it for our team. And it was a special time that, I mean, to win 15-9, I think the record was. I don't know if they've beaten that. If we've beaten that away, I don't think we have.
I don't think so, no.
But to do that in the States is fairly special.
It was a pretty good team, although it doesn't always count that way. I always looked at the 1993 GB&I team, which was stacked with guys that went on to play, were good enough to play on tour and win on tour, and they got absolutely humped.
Really?
So you can never tell.
Yeah. I think also maybe that era was a time, because quite like GMAC and Luke, for instance, were US-based players already. Traveled so much. Amateur golf had come on already. It's even more so now. Yeah. But in my time, we were going all over the world to play golf. It was only the summer we played our events. The rest of the time we were on playing. We were doing the same thing we did as professionals, to be fair. So probably helped us a little bit as well. Going to the States and competing on a course like that wasn't brand new to us.
Mm-hmm. How did you compare with Luke Donald at that point?
Well, because we'd never competed against each other. Mm. So, and obviously I was bulletproof member, so I thought I was better.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot that, sorry.
I remember the thing that stood out immediately to me was his composure on the golf course. He was so quiet, very unemotional, which is a real strength for him. Mm. And his short game even then was electric. He was short, but he was reliable.
I remember being at the previous Walker Cup, which was at Nairn, Scotland, and he played with Paul Casey in the foursomes. Mm. And I remember writing at the time that those two at that point were good enough to play in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
Never mind the Walker
Cup. Yeah. He was a special player. I mean, he's proven that, hasn't he, with his career he's gone on to do. But, and the great thing, I think it's a great example as well, when people watch the game, you wonder, well, what creates longevity is that he never really messed around with what he had.
Mm, he looks the same now.
Because even when he was world number one, people in powerful positions within our game questioned how his game could be a number one in the world sort of game, which would have hurt, I'd imagine. You think, I'm world number one. You know,
he had, to my mind, that you can correct me if you disagree, but that my mind, looking back at him now, is that his formula for success was pretty limited. I mean, he held everything for about 18 months. Mm. I mean, everything. And that was the only way that somebody that, as you said, could hit as far as he did.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's ever going to get to number one again playing like that.
No.
If we don't change the equipment.
I agree with that. Yeah. I think it goes beyond the putter. You're right. The putter was phenomenal. He is, for me, the best bunker player in the world still. His wedge play is something you just thought, he's always going to have a chance to save pars even when he makes mistakes because he was so good with his wedges. And it really shone a light for me, even when we play together quite a bit on tour, whether it be in the States or here, it was a different ball game. I mean, they're all like that now, John, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't think of many guys that you'd say have got bad wedge games. So you've just got to have one because they hit wedges all the time, don't they? Into par four. So,
exactly. Yes.
But he was, and it wasn't even the full wedges, that 60, 70, 80 yarders. But to be fair, he spends, and still does to this day, an inordinate amount of time working on it. you know, I have to admire that. As you get older, so he's done it. You know, he's not going to be Luke Donald he used to be. It. Doesn't have to prove it, and yet he's still a grafter. Mm-hmm. He looks like he enjoys his life probably a little bit more than he did back then. But still, the work ethic is just as strong, someone like Luke Donald.
I want to keep on the good stuff theme. You're a man who led a US Open after one round, and memorably, I was there covering the tournament, played with Tiger on day three, which now that round, I've always held that round up in a not a negative way, but a slightly different way. Tiger shot 69 that day on a golf course, playing at the top of his game. And he only shot 69, and it was 68 was the best score of the day. Steve Stricker shot 68, only two scores under 70. Yeah. Now, I maintain that there was something wrong with the golf course that day.
Right.
If Tiger Woods, at the top of his game, shoots 69, there's something wrong with the course.
He played better than that. So my recollection, so the same. So on the first day when I led, the only two of us broke par as well. It was a brute. Yeah. I must admit, you're seeing it from an architectural point of view as well, in terms of what was, from a player's standpoint, what the reason that I always love the US Open is that part of me really adore the brutality and lack of fairness to it. Because let's be honest, golf is a particularly unfair game. Yeah. But once you get past that, you can get to enjoy that a little bit.
And I think it's the best course in the world, or could be, with no rough.
Yeah, and zero to be fair, it's hard enough without it.
Yeah.
You know, so that day with Tiger, that doesn't paint the picture of how he played, because so when people ask me about days I'd live in my life again, none of the day I'd pick as the one for my career wouldn't be any of the wins. It would be that day, because to play with Tiger in his prime in a major championship when you're in contention, that's not happening anymore, you know, and that's special. Whereas four times a year, people get that opportunity normally. I remember going out and I was very nervous, and people had said to me, "Don't worry, he's not a great driver. You'll be fine." Well, he hit this baby little fade off every single tee to put it in play, because he knew that was the name of the game there. He hit 13 and 14 fairways. And because he hit 13 and 14 fairways, the only one he missed, ironically, was the last. He hit it a foot into the right, the thick rough on the right side. He couldn't reach the green. Yeah. That was the only green he missed that day. Mm-hmm. And the bit I remember standing out for me was, in the world where we're all hanging on for dear life in a US Open, which is arguably the spirit in which it's designed, that championship, just cling on for dear life, scramble, try and keep it out the heavy stuff. Don't make sixes and sevens. He was playing it like an arcade game. And it was like a kid going out, having a knock with his mates. He'd hit this little shot in the fairway, and then wherever the flag was, he'd work it down the middle of the green, bleed it to the right flag, turning it in. So always getting closer. Mm-hmm. He was painting pictures, John, in a tournament, which is not about painting pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember, more than anyone, I haven't played with Mickelson, but I played with everyone else. Vijay, when he was world number one, Ernie, obviously, even some of our greater players, although they're a little bit older when I got on tour, our older, greater players. I was the most I've ever felt different to a professional golfer.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought, it's not even the same world.
What you just described is familiar or similar to what I saw in the President's Cup at Royal Melbourne. Mm. When he played the last time it was there. Mike, we've touched on this before. Mike Clayton and I walked and watched him, and he was miles better than everybody else on that golf course. Mm. Even at that stage of his career, I mean, he's quite, you know.
He's a great thinker, wasn't he, as well?
It was an education to watch.
Yeah, and there's a misconception with Tiger that he's, because you see shots like the one he hit out the bunker to win the Canadian Open, you know.
Yeah.
And you see some of the heroics over the years, and some of the walking after it, and the aggression in the body language. He was really conservative as a golfer. Mm. He never took risks that weren't worth it. He played the percentages all the time. And because he had these moments and hold those clutch putts that seemed so meaningful, we all in our mind think he was this guy who just ran out with his sword and took it to the golf courses. He didn't really. Mm. He'd follow Jack's advice, and he'd let others beat themselves in the major championships. And, you know, his course management was impeccable. And actually that day, he missed everything. He didn't, I wouldn't say he putted badly, but he missed everything.
Nothing went in.
Nothing went in.
Yeah.
And it was about as bad a score as he could shoot. Mm-hmm. But I remember being on the 14th green. I had a putt for a birdie. I think it was the 14th. I made a birdie to get within one of him. So I got back to level par, which I'm not even paying attention to what's going on. I'm right in the US Open now, round three. Yeah. But I'm all in on Tiger, right? And that's what I'm here. I'm here for the Tiger show. Yeah, I'm eating up every minute. People say, don't get to the first tee early. I'm there literally as a group in front of off the tee. Yeah. I want all of the vibes. I want to feel it, what it's like.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. But I allowed myself on that green to believe I might beat him, you know? And then a double 15.
Yeah.
I took my eye off the ball. I lost focus. One thing that Tiger would definitely never do. Yeah. Double that. And then I was playing tennis across that 17th green. Couldn't find it from missed just off the green, but in that hay across the green. And I bogeyed the last as well. I dropped four shots in the last four holes to shoot four over, which again was better than the average score that day. Yeah. But it also blew my, because I finished five behind Cabrera at the end of that US Open. And I blew four needlessly down those last four
one
holes.
One thing changes, everything changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Learned so much watching him that day.
I was also
in awe.
Did he know who you were?
Yeah. I mean, I remember my first interaction with Tiger was stood in the gents' toilets and I was next to him. And it's like, you know, obviously you got to do the right thing and not look at him, obviously, when you're at the urinal.
Yeah.
And he went, "You're right, Nick." And I thought, oh my God, he knows my name. Yeah, which was, because out of any of the guys, and bear in mind, I've been around Nick Fowler since I was 15.
Well, there was another Nick on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. I didn't think about that. Yeah. And none of them. I'm not starstruck with professional, especially not now, because they've just been around the game. And obviously you have a perspective on life. You realize that they're incredible at their skill, but this is just golf, you know. But Tiger does have that. And still I get interviewing him, even doing the job now, I get not nerves in a bad way, but there's an anticipation because he's just a special golfer, a special athlete that we might never see the likes of again. And I know he'll not get past Jack. And, you know, it's very difficult comparing golfers across areas, of course.
It depends how you define it. I mean, I always say that Tiger, as you say, he's not going to pass Jack Nicklaus in terms of majors. Yeah. But no one's ever played golf better than Tiger Woods. His 100%. Best golf is the best we've ever seen.
That's exactly how I describe it, exactly how you just described it. So when people ask me, I will caveat it because people can always come back with, well, majors don't add up though, do they? And, you know, and the injuries, some of them down to him, personal stuff. Again, it's all part of being an athlete. You've got to manage all these things. Granted, it's not just bad luck.
Yeah. Plus, he's the only guy who's ever won majors with about five different swings.
I know. But I do exactly what you said. When people ask me, I say, I don't believe golf has ever been played in a moment in time better than Tiger did in his pump. It's something to behold. Because he's still tapped into he was still in a generation where there was some artistry.
Yes.
And it has changed.
Yeah, there was a subtlety to it.
There was.
Yeah.
And the majors would help bring it out a little bit.
I tell you who else was like that was your mate Nick Faldo gets a bad rap on being a robot and all the rest of it. Mm. Nothing could be further from the truth. Mm. Very subtle, the way he played.
Oh, well, I remember Nick, forever talking about the one thing, first time I'd ever heard 1 yard draw.
Yeah.
I'm like, what do you mean a 1 yard draw? So it was straight, mate. He says, not straight, that. It's because it's the feel. Because I'm feeling 1 yard draw. I feel like I'm taking the left out. I minimize the chance of in it left.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Because for me, it fade out to move 10 yards. And
I heard a story about him just this week. An equipment guy was telling me that the Faldo had gone out and tested ping I2s or whatever they were. And he shot 65 and they were rubbing their hands thinking, oh, he's going to, you know, and he gave them back. He said, no, they're too straight.
Is that what he said?
He couldn't move the ball a little bit. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's something, it's obviously changed, doesn't it, in the modern day game. And you see the guys driving now with the traces, don't see much shape in it. Technology's not helping that. It's trying to make the ball go straighter. Mm-hmm. But I think also the guys have adapted to that's how we play. Yeah. So they've adapted that mentality of, I'm going to go direct
routes. Well, that's, you know, goodness knows, the listeners must be tired of me banging on about this, but it's not just how far the ball goes. It doesn't go sideways enough either, you know.
Yeah, and you know, to a degree, sometimes I think the shape was a comfort when it was easier to move the ball because you could work the ball into spaces. Mm. Whereas now, I mean, if you hit the ball dead straight, and I'm guilty of this, I try and hit it straight off the tee, but the fairway's not as big. Mm. One, because I'm hitting it further now, John, at 41, and bet like playing four times a year than I did in my heyday. And that's technology, right? I mean, I'm probably in better shape than I was then, but when I'm hitting balls all day, like I used to every day, you know, so technology's moved me up there. So I hit the ball over 300 yards still, which is too far for my accuracy.
Right? Or lack of.
Yeah, or lack of. Whereas I remember, like, obviously back in the day, you could work the ball a little bit more into positions, you know, and you just don't really see that so much now. And also you feel like you're losing out because, you know, like here, we're stood looking across at the 18th on the Emirates. Like, you've got to whip it across that corner. There's no, you can't afford to hit it out to the right and give yourself a wood into that green.
It's extraordinary the line they take.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's almost direct now, especially because they can launch it so high they can get it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, so... for me, technology has been amazing for golf as a whole because golf is too hard for amateurs, right?
Yeah.
It is too hard.
It is.
I watch my dad. Golf's made it so much fun. My dad hits it like he did. I mean, dad's in his mid-70s. He hits it like he did when he was 45, 50.
Yeah.
It means he can enjoy golf. And he can still play back because he doesn't want to go forward. You know what I mean? He still wants to play from the
ego.
No, exactly. Yeah. And he can. And it's made the game easier, which is wonderful. But for the very best players... it's made, obviously, golf courses difficult to play as they should do.
Yeah.
And you can't blame players. You got to do what you got to do with the canvas that's in front of you.
Yeah.
And they're finding way to make pretty pictures with
golf. I must admit, I've been quite amused by, in the wake of the recent rollback, if we can call it that, is that, you know, the reaction of the amateurs, they're going to lose 1 year.
Yeah.
Amateurs, their technique's so bad. Yeah, they've got no idea how far the ball's going to go. So how can you tell how far you've lost?
I don't know how far. The amount I play now, I know roughly what my numbers are, but they're rough. And I never hit the same shot twice.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I think for amateurs, I'd say don't be worried. It's going to be fine. It's going to be absolutely fine. And they got a bit longer as well. But they're going to be absolutely fine. I saw a few people saying, well, what am I going to do with these balls? They should be on tour. If they think they're going to keep the balls they've got, like a few dozen balls at home for the next 10 years or whatever.
You can always tell bad golfers have got nothing but new balls in their bag.
Yeah. For the professionals, I think it will bring in some other courses, which is great. You know, and the manufacturers are brilliant at what they do. They will still find ways to...
That's the trouble.
They will still find... They are brilliant at what they do. And, you know, in the end... it's an awkward one, isn't it? Because people love to watch Rory hit it. Mm. So it is important to the manufacturer that Rory's playing what they're playing. Because they want them to go, like, oh, I love that. And like they want to go and use that driver. You know, Tommy won with you know, a brand new driver last week. Great advert for the golf club. But at the same time, the amateurs really need the help. Whereas the top professionals, some courses, and we see this in links golf, you know, you get scared every time the open goes back to the old course, right? Oh. If you get a calm week, and the only ones that really hold their ground are US Opens because of the nature of how they can set them.
It's just,
you know, where you know, if you miss fairways, there is...
It becomes awfully boring to watch.
Although having said that, the one that shocked me, and it did make me start, because I must admit, it's only been more recent times that it's really struck a chord with me, DeChambeau winning Wingfoot. That doesn't happen at Wingfoot.
No.
When Jeff won there, I played when Jeff won there.
You
don't get around like that. And one of the miracles for me is that Phil had six runners up at US Open because he's an incredible golfer, but you just can't get away historically with missing fairways. And Phil misses his fair share, right?
Well, at Wingfoot, I mean, the classic, just was partly the result of it. They caught up with him because he'd been all over the shop all day.
And just managed to.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great guy to watch play, though.
Oh.
I mean, I love watching Phil play the game. Yeah, I mean, they defend themselves, but some of these courses now where they're having to put new tees and that, you know, I think that the factors are undeniable of why this action's been taken. And I think it's news now. And when it first comes into action, there'll be some noise, but people will be used to it. But by then, they'll be hitting it as far as they are anyway.
They should have done four times what they've, you know, to my mind, to actually make a real difference.
It's pacifying though, isn't it? It's that classic, the politics of our game, of trying to keep, and stakeholders as well, the PGA Tour haven't been supportive to this point of it. But again, they're representing the players, aren't they? And the players, if you're a golfer, from a selfish point of view, I don't want to sit shorter. You know, most of them probably sit in that if they haven't taken a real deep dive into the reasoning and why and how much and how, you know, in their mind, I'm sure some of the short hitters think, well, I'm the one who's going to get completely, you know, turned over with this. And actually he's like, well, not really. No, it's not as big of a gap for those guys as it will be for the longer hitters in terms of what they'll drop.
But they won't even notice.
I think pros are notes.
Well, yeah, the
pros are notes.
No,
amateurs
because they have no idea how far they how.
Yeah,
they don't make solid contact very often. You
know, yeah, it's just replication.
It's not to be brutal about this, but they don't.
Replication of shots is, you know, with a top player, you're going to see that. So if they're going to, and they'll dial it in, they'll adapt super quick because they're that good. But But amateur golfers, I think, will find it a bit, it'll be a non-event, I think, yeah. personally.
Yeah.
I think it's the idea of it, that someone's stolen some yardage from them that actually offends them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker? At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf Lowest Price Guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Anyway, as I knew would happen with this, is that we wandered off, and I wanted to, without leaving your pro career behind it, the highlight was obviously that round at Oakmont, it sounds like, but what were the others?
Winning at St Andrews, Jack said only the great champions win at the old course. He meant the Open, but that's just detail. to win there was really special. Yeah. Well, you know, there's nothing like it. There is nothing like it. All of the wins were special in their own way because winning the first time, and, you know, holding off Monty and Thomas Bjorn in the final group to win in Singapore when I was 22 years old was awesome, and young as well to win on tour, although maybe not as much these days. And then the last one, because it was on the back of losing mum, although special now, at the time actually was a very weird experience for me. But I think, ironically, that I'm most proud of, and I ask this to guys all the time, a major championship or world number one. I know the world rankings have taken a bit of a bashing in recent times.
Yeah.
It's complicated with everything going on in the world, isn't it, to make a system that works fairly.
I just get rid of them.
But I always, for me, saying you're the number one in the world is something that's really special.
Yeah, but there's no basis in reality. I mean, you know as well as I do, the number one player in the world is a different guy every day.
In terms of on a day.
Yeah.
But across a bit, the person who is in that time period, the best golfer, like for instance, Tiger was easy because he was so far ahead, right? But then when Vijay closed the gap on him, it was meaningful that. Mm. And for me, being able to say I'm one of the top 50 golfers in the world when I was at that period, I really hang my hat on that. Yeah. Like, I'm really proud of that, as much as any of the wins, to be honest. Because it's...
But there's no real way of measuring it.
It's a hard one to get right when there's different tours. If they're all on the same tour, then...
Different courses, different days, different weather. Everything's...
Yeah, it's not a perfect science, but the... But for me, it's still, I hope they find a system going forward. Or the game itself might change to a degree where there's a...
I'm not sure that they're even needed by anybody, you know.
No,
the majors don't need them. They quite happily filled up their fields long before the world rankings came along, and I'm sure they could do it again.
I mean, some of the, like for instance, you know, like PGA Tour signature events are, you know, top 30 category and that, getting into those as well. If you're standout on this tour or when you hit the ground running, you can climb in there pretty quick. Like Abe Orberg's good showing us how quickly you can climb that mountain. But like, I think the reward to play any way you want at any time. I think in my day, it really was like, it was a top 50 category got you in, got me in plenty of events that wouldn't have got in otherwise. And I earned that. Because I didn't have a full PGA Tour card, I had to earn that through our tour. I'm playing well, like, you know, obviously you get nice points when you play well in the US Open, you know.
It's almost got the point now where somebody playing exclusively on the DP World Tour, you're not going to get the top 50.
That's the problem.
Unless you win every week.
I know they're in a state of transition. That's the politest way of putting it, I think, where they're trying to find out. But it's hard for the guys at the World Rankings to make a plan when you don't really know exactly where this is going to end up. At some stage, live golfers have to get points if you're going to have a system, because they're legitimately really good players on that tour. There are some legitimately and a great player in John Rahm, but it's complicated. But if there's an agreement reached where somehow there's a merging where the tour can become like a one place for the top players,
the biggest issue I have with the live, it's not the three rounds or the shotgun start, it's the fact that there's a conflict with, sometimes if you're playing for a team and playing for yourself, there's going to come a situation, which has already happened, whereby do I lag this putt up for the benefit of the team, or do I try and hold it for the benefit of me?
There was one recently, wasn't there?
You can't have that.
No.
You just can't.
No. I must admit, I like the team element of golf.
So do I.
And I think it works with the top 48 players in the game.
Yeah,
I think if you have all of them, then you have the stars that we love watching. And also, I'm a big believer. I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, I'm a Man United fan, which I get a lot of stick for, being born in Liverpool. Yeah. But I love like the friendly ribbon of my Scouse mates when they're Liverpool fans. You know, not that I get to do that very often these days, but rooting for a team and against in a night. I'm not saying rooting in a bad way, but like, you know, taking a bit of joy, a bit of a giggle when Liverpool lost 2-1, for instance. Yeah. I might give him a bit of a joke with him.
By the way, this is for a Golf Australia magazine. Rooting, and you've got to say barracking.
Okay, barracking.
Barracking means, barracking. In Australian, means why? I have no idea.
Oh, really?
People, if somebody wants to tell me why that came, how that came about, barracking means cheering for.
Oh, really?
We would think we would think the opposite.
Yeah, no, would they? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, just an
aside. Yeah, I enjoy barracking for a team.
Yeah.
I think it adds an element of fun to it, because in golf, you generally, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's the odd player here and there, which people will enjoy rooting against, but but for most of us...
Are you thinking of Patrick Reed by any chance?
I wouldn't have actually gone with him, but I can see where that comes from. Yeah. But the there's certainly players where, if you've got teams, you would have someone that you'd have invested in. Like, it's my favourite team because it's got, for instance, I'm a DJ fan, for instance. It's got DJ.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm a John Rahm fan and this is John's team or whatever. I can see that with top 48 guys. But as it is at the moment, which isn't the finished product, to be fair, to anyone that's involved with any of this, it's fractured. And this is the only dangerous ground we're in at the moment.
Well, this is an opportunity.
Mm.
This, if they're going to get it right, let's get it right now. Because if you don't, it's going to be hell of a difficult...
Yeah.
Somewhere down the road to change it back again.
Acquiring John Rahm was a huge step. Yeah. And £600 million sounds a lot, but actually in terms of the power of that, in terms of enforcing the hand of the game, the ones they've had so far, they're great players, they're major champions.
Yeah.
And I know Brooks won a major last year, but I don't feel he's at the peak of his powers. John's at the peak of his powers. Like, he is legitimately, with Rory and Scotty on any given week, it's hard to say, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, they're the three best players in the game.
I mean, Brooks Koepka has come out, he said this publicly. I mean, he took the live money because he had pressure marks over his ability to play much longer because of his knee. So I don't blame him in that respect. And I get why the likes of their time of life was Poulter, McDowell, Westwood.
Mm-hmm.
I get completely why they did it. And speaking of Westwood and Liv, I've said this to him, so I'm not speaking out of school. I said, the biggest problem Liv's got is, and if I'm the typical golf fan, and I probably am in many ways, I'm not that interested.
Mm.
I can't get into it. I don't care who wins.
I think one of the hard things as well is that, you know, much like when you look at YouTubers, it's a congested space and you're fighting for attention. Same with TV, right? But obviously... TV, this is in the UK now, and the go-to place for golf is Sky Sports Golf.
Yes, of course.
With golf itself, though, like, it's there's different territories bidding and trying to steal attention, and that makes it challenging. Mm. So PGA Tour have always had the mainstay of that action. DP World Tour, we have our window, and especially now with the scheduling, like when we get to the end of the FedEx Cup season. As it is right now today, I really like what I'm seeing with the DP World Tour. There's that back nine, which is these great events where we will hopefully get a bit of, like this week, a bit of Brian Harman, Cameron Young, maybe some like a Justin Thomas. That's what I'm hoping, because they're off. The top players who don't have to go into that full season are off.
Yes.
Not losing ground, not missing out on points.
Yeah.
Come here. You know, I'm sure they'll earn a few quid while they're here and play as well.
Yeah,
great for the viewers.
Yeah,
bring in the audience and shines a light on this tour.
Culturally, this tour is way better than the PGA Tour.
Well, they all said Max Homer spoke so beautifully about it when he visited for the Nedbank. You know, and guys, always traditionally across the years when they've come, people love coming to play on the DP World Tour, and that could be their window. At the moment, my concern with an agreement coming with Liv and the PGA Tour is how do the three tours fit into that space?
We had a little meeting with, we're speaking here at the Emirates, the Dubai Desert Classic, and we had a little meeting, sit down with Keith Pelly this morning, and I asked him that very question, where does the European Tour fit? He see it fitting as we go forward, and he couldn't answer it.
Yeah, funny enough, because I'm catching up with Keith tomorrow. That's the question I was going to ask him as well.
If you get an answer out of him, you're doing better than
us. As a member, I only worry... because I think they've done a great job of finding this window for us. And you know what? I know a lot of people don't like the 10 cards. When I was playing on tour, the ambition was to, and I was playing more. I was playing Bay Hill and playing Harbour Town and playing those events because in the end, I want to play most of my golf. And it's where the biggest prizes.
The really good ones will go anyway.
Yeah. And that's what's always happened.
And I tell you what, I'd be surprised if, I think more than half of them will be back here next year.
because they might lose their buying privileges. Yeah. But especially now with the golfing prize money between, and don't get me wrong, I see, you know, we know it's record prize money on the DP World Tour, but what's happened in the States is off the charts, not sustainable probably, but the money, of course, you want to play in those fields and in those events. Yeah. That's the pinnacle of the game right now, outside of majors, obviously. But if they're going to make that work, and so having 10 cards to go here, I think it's just made what's always really happened an official thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't see that as a bad thing. Yeah. I think it's a dream. It's part of the dream for players starting who come through Europe and want
to
make
it. I tell you who else you should talk to is Jorge Campillo.
Right.
Doesn't want to go.
Doesn't want to go.
But he doesn't care.
And that's, you know what? That's the same for, it's been the same for other players in the past. They don't like playing in the States. Yeah. But I mean, I think for the majority, they're going to enjoy that privilege. I think
the quote he gave me last week was, I'm not super excited about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Should give it to someone else.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, there's Rasmus Højgaard.
Pass it down the chain.
He's gagging to go.
And I thought that was, again, added a storyline to the DP World Tour Championships at the end of last year. You can see his fate, and ironic, because you've got the brother who's just won the Tour Champs, and then you've got Rasmus, who's literally, by a smidgen, missed out on this card, which is his season, right?
He missed 2.5 months because of injury.
And he is good enough to go out there and make his way. But so I like that. I think there's been some great things that are in play as it is right now. But I just feel like the PGA Tour season, calendar season they're doing now, works. It works for them as well, competing against other sports, which is obviously a problem in the States. Mm-hmm. Finish at the FedEx Cup, the Tour Champs. Start of September, DP World. Off you go.
Yeah, exactly.
That feels like a legitimate place for LIV.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to go, okay, best players back on the PGA Tour, however they do it with any compensation or whatever it's going to be, however they do that, I wouldn't fancy that job, trying to work that one out. But they come back, they can play. But then the best players, the whole original concept, which is Andy Gardner's concept of the PGL, top 48 players in the world, of which they're pretty much PGA Tour players on that tour then for that window where they're not playing anything else. That seems like that would work really well, but not if you're the DP World Tour.
No.
And I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not saying that anyone's at fault for that, because it's just the predicament we all find ourselves in.
Yeah.
And I'll be interested to see how that works out, because what's been a really good thing this year for them, and I really think that will shine at the end of this year, that run of events, big events, well, great events, fun events, good venues, and this tour will look amazing. I hope that doesn't thwart all that.
Yeah. Moving right along, let's talk about life too for you. What do you put down on your job description or job title? What are you, a commentator, an analyst, a pundit, or you know, what are you?
Broadcaster.
And what does that mean?
Because I'm not a commentator. I mean, I do commentate, but I'm the presenter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the presenter's job is different to the commentary job. And the idea of that being that you, when you're a presenter, you're steering the ship. So it's a great responsibility, one that I feel very honored to do, because I get to tell that story, especially at major championships. You know, for instance, my first major that I anchored was the Masters when Tiger won in 2019. And what a privilege and an honor to be the person that starts that story, navigates that ship, in the presentation part, and then obviously in commentary, the lead role, say it's you and doing it. I do lead as well sometimes, but also color. Andrew does lead, but also color. Ewan's our main lead, has been for a long time. It's our job to steer the story, and then the insights come from all the guests and the plethora of talent that works through. So for me, I present, I commentate, I actually interview as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's my least favorite part of the job, that, the interviewing.
Yeah. So you're getting... That's the closest to journalism, because there's a difference between broadcasting and journalism.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's harder because
sometimes you've got to ask the hard one.
You do, and the problem for us is there is a lot of politics involved, and the game as it is now with players, more so in the States, there's an element of careful what you ask. You can damage relationships.
I know the answer to this, but you've had players, right, that's it, I'm not speaking to this guy for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we had obviously the tough one with Phil.
Yeah.
That wasn't me actually presenting that week, but our presenter that week was James Haddock, and he actually asked legitimate question, but he wouldn't let it go. He asked again, and Phil didn't like it. But again, as you say, when you're asking a difficult question, they're not always going to like it. And what I will tend to do it makes it more challenging that I have friendships with a lot of these guys, because it is hard, because you think, I go ask you something, they're not going to lie.
Yeah.
Tends to not be often, because in the end, we're mainly interviewing the guys that are playing well, but when stuff breaks, then it can be challenging. I'll generally give them a heads up that I'm going to cover a subject, because what I don't want, TV's different to being stood in front of a microphone. They're not going to refuse to answer that you're on live TV. So I don't want to throw them under the bus in that regard. I want to give them an opportunity to think about their answer.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather that than get a headline from something that because they've dropped the ball and stumbled because they panicked.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, with the difference with what we do have that then issue, if it is a top player and you've upset them, and sometimes it's legit. I mean, the thing I always go by is, if I say something, whether it's in commentary or I ask something, and they question me on it afterwards and say, why did you do that? Or I can justify, I did that because. If I can explain myself, it was legitimate. If I'm embarrassed that I said it, then I'm at fault and I probably owe them an apology. And I try to not get that wrong. But again, even when we're doing our job in commentary, you make mistakes. You know, you go down an alley with something and then you get a bit stuck and then and you think, oh no, I didn't mean it like that. It's really easy to get yourself in trouble, especially in a day in a world with social media.
Players I'll tell my Tom Lehman story briefly here. They won it both ways. Back at the Brookline Ryder Cup with the stampede over the green, I wrote a column that night just kind of laying waste to the Americans for what they did and singled Tom Lehman out because he was the first guy on the green. 2 weeks later, I'm at the Dunhill Cup, the old Dunhill Cup at St Andrews, walking along the back of the range, and he sees me. He goes, right, I want to speak to you. And he takes me out in the middle of the range about 50 yards from everybody and starts giving me the finger in the chest bit about how dare I sum up his whole character on the basis of one incident, to which I responded, well, how dare you sum up my opinion of you on the basis of one column? I said, I've written any number of things about you over the years, Tom, and until now they've been 100% positive.
Yeah.
But I've never heard from you before. I don't think this is very fair.
Yeah.
To which he swore and stumped off. He's since apologized. We've come, you know, Tom and I are...
Sometimes it's the way the relationship's
come to. He wanted it both ways. Yeah. Now, if he'd come to me every time I'd written something nice about him and said, thank you for doing that, I would have stood there and taken that.
Yeah, but I get that.
You know what I mean?
I get that. Yeah. I think there's a couple of things I'd say. One thing that I noticed, especially in presses, when we sit in the presses, because we get great stuff from you. Like tomorrow when I'm speaking to Rory, I'll come in and watch you guys do your presser with him. And he'll have tough questions sometimes, depending on what's going on, like he did last year. There was something that he didn't like. Can't remember who it was now. Someone asked him. I wouldn't name and shame anyway, but they asked him a question he didn't like. He's going to come back in here and do a presser again. You know, you're going to have access to him again. Yeah. With TV, that's not always, and Rory's a bad example because we've never had. That's, and one thing, credit where credit's due with Rory. Like, I if I want to go somewhere, I will again give him that heads up of I want to talk. Yeah. He will never say no, and he, because he understands the game. I get it.
I had criticism of recently, criticizing him for answering questions.
Oh no!
Well, no, come on.
No, and we need that. I mean, in the end, you want guys to. It's the same as the whole Tyrrell thing when you know about the, you know, when he's. The toys are out or whatever on the course. It's like,
he's so funny.
And an element, like, what have we got rid of him? Like,
I don't know.
Like, what do you want to see? Do you want to see someone walking out, emotionless face? We're like, we do need the character. And you know what? And granted, I mean, and this is a great chance to say it as well. Although I don't know what the regulations are in Australia, but like the swearing. Oh, we get all the time. So we have to apologize. Right, yeah. We have to apologize every single time on Sky.
Yeah.
And I know that when you're out there in the battle, you're not thinking about, is there a fluffy mic behind me?
Yeah.
You're in the moat and it gets on top of you and you say things you shouldn't say. Yeah. But we have to apologize. People are always having to go, why are you apologizing? It's like, it's Ofcom regulations. Yeah. It's how it works. But we need those characters and you need them to have something to say. And to be honest, and again, even going back to the Ryder Cup, like the best thing that happened there in our, because it was great because we had Zynga come in with, I had Zynga and Nick Faldo. So Nick Faldo in the studio with me for the last day for the singles. And then the Hatgate stuff. It was fantastic because as much as I thought it was a really good Ryder Cup anyway, and obviously the underdog was socking it to the American side, which is always a nice story. Like all of a sudden there was a bit of juice. Like it became a bit personal. I mean, and it was, I mean, Shane out on that green.
Yeah.
And as much as there's elements of, when the swearing and whatever, we have to apologize. Live sport is an emotional experience. And when you're watching on TV or if you listen on the radio, but the guy do a great job actually with the radio painting those pictures. But when you can see it all unfolding, it adds to the value, right? Yeah. You are now more engaged as a European fan when you're seeing that on that green and you're seeing Rory get animated. And the next day, I think people would have been twice as jacked up to watch the Europeans beat the Americans.
Why do you think it is that they behave so differently?
And I think they're allowed.
Certainly emotionally and under pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, you see them, you know, it's even worse than a major. My mind always goes back to Jay Haas in 1995 at Oak Hill, playing the last hole with Philip Walton. The man could barely walk.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who's won tournaments and, you know, it's where's your theory on all that?
I think it's being part of a team when you're playing for something other than yourself. The camaraderie, and I can only relate to team events I've played before, but even a Seve Trophy, I played three of them, like representing a group of guys and playing for guys that you try and beat all the time, your friends in that arena. And obviously the Ryder Cup's a wholly different ballgame. It's such a big thing. Like even Rory coming out with the biggest thing in golf right now is to win an away Ryder Cup. Shows you what it means to him. And for Europeans in particular, it's easier. Because there's all this, like, they've been constant over the years, they've been beaten heavily, like, oh, bring it, you know, why don't you add, you know, add the rest of Europe and all that sort of stuff. And as much as that was fuel, and obviously it's not where the game is now, that undertone is always there. And that underdog spirit is always there. It's relentless. And guys like Rory, and when you see Rory getting fired, like, I'm going with him when I'm watching and when I'm working. And the hardest thing for me at the Ryder Cup is, like, have some composure, Nick. Yeah. I mean, your job here is to, like, not go with it. And sometimes the guests will do it. It's great when they do. You know, and so, for instance, that morning with Nick and Zing, I mean, Nick was into Zynga. Like, he turned his chair. So normally we're sat there because we don't normally do a desk, but we're sharing the studio with NBC. And Zynga was great, came in, did his thing. But we ran in the stuff with Seve, you know, like... Which again is one of those moments, John, where I'm a bit, as much as it's our producer and our team, and you know, he's been warned that we're going to cover this stuff.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about animosity within the room, what it can add, what you can respond to, how it can elevate your game, all this sort of stuff. But Nick was all in, and the competitive juices of when he was a player were fully back. He turned his chair to face Zynga. So he's looking at the side of his head as he's talking down the camera.
Yeah.
And he's not giving. So I just like, he sort of sat, and that's where
sit back and
it makes for great TV. I mean, and that's the thing. You can't force these things in TV. You can't make people have fake arguments or debates. But when they do pull in different directions, it always makes for the best.
Well, that was Brando Chambly and Frank Noble used to have that on the Golf Channel. They would go at it.
Yeah.
They just disagreed.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, we've seen that with Paul and Brando as well across time. I mean, I remember with the first one with...
Well, Brando's done it with everybody.
I must admit, I enjoy listening to him.
Yeah, he's terrific. I don't always agree with him either, but
no, don't always agree with his.
But he's very good at what he does.
Oh, God, so articulate, and the I really rate him. And some of his points, he makes me think, which I like. So one thing that I'm passionate about is I have opinions. I have a premeditated idea about how I think this all works. When I sit down with someone, I have the questions I have in my head are based on what I would want to talk about.
Yeah.
Which isn't always, so I have to try and think. Well, hang on, where's he coming from? You know. So when it's someone like Zynga and Nick, and also it's not my arena.
Yeah.
Tee
them up and let them run.
Yeah. And I also don't, it's the one tournament, I don't know what that feels like to peg that up on that first tee.
Yeah.
So I haven't really got, I can literally be a fan or I can be truly like a journalist who's not done it because I haven't done it, you know, in a Ryder Cup environment. And arguably it makes my job a bit easier because when you have a preconceived idea about what these guys are going to say, you can lead them too much, which I can be guilty of sometimes because I know where the talking points are and I can also see where we're going to go next and the rest of it. But being able to ask the guys and get them to sort of feed off what they're sort of talking about is the main part of this job. And when they give you the good nuggets and like they come out with stuff that you've not heard before and they go there. And I think the Ryder Cup allows for that. More than anything, because they talk about emotional stuff. You know, you never hear like stay in your process and one shot at a time.
Yeah.
You hear more. You're going to get out there. You get in their face early on. You make them put that 2 footer on the first green. You stand there, arms folded, looking at them, and you hear that. You think, oh yeah, this is sport.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it's because it's got an aggression to it, which we. In a fine way, it's got an aggression to it that we don't see a lot in our game. And it's sort of gently, isn't it? We through Thursday, Friday, and then we get to a Sunday of a major and it lights up. sometimes.
What did you make of it last year when the Americans, most of them pitched up having hardly played for almost a month?
Yeah, I think that was extraordinary. My concern with that, and again, with the reports of what was being talked about with the money and that, which was, Nick had a great line on it. He said, if I was a captain again, and that was in my team, and I'd heard that, I'd ask him what flight they wanted, tonight or tomorrow morning, to go home. It's like, never happening. And, you know, when you're a guy who's got a legacy like he does in the Ryder Cup, and what it meant and what it still means, and then you've got guys who are still, some of the ones talking about it, haven't done that much. It's like that naive sort of, and I know Rory made this mistake once upon a time.
When he was a kid.
When he was a kid when he said it. And guys make mistakes and then learn. No, it's life, right? We all do it. But some of the stuff, if that ever happened, and of course there is money made in a roundabout way from a Ryder Cup, but it would take away the one thing that makes it so special, because you know that it matters when they're in tears like Rory was at Whistling Straits. I mean, what amazing TV.
Yeah.
When it's the first time, he's a great talker and he's sincere, but you felt like, I know him like a brother when you watch him in that, because your heart went out for him because he was, it was a mess. And then you see what it meant to win at this time. If we lose that, that is our one thing emotionally in the game. Because even in majors, there's the emotions, sure.
Yeah.
But it's one man's emotions. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is a bigger thing and what it stands for.
And there's huge pressure on the best players on each team.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as simple as this.
Yeah.
If the best three players in your team all play well and win most of the games, you're going to win.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's exactly what happened. You look at the best three players on the European team last year, Ram, Rory, Hovland. 10.5 points.
Yeah.
Without actually playing with each other.
Yeah. That was Tom McGinley's point.
It's all over, isn't it?
If the best players do their job, you're on for a winner.
Yeah.
But it's got to mean that. And I think if we ever lost that and it went the way that the rest of this game has, because the player power is stronger than ever, I don't like that particularly. I understand how it's gone that way. And I do think the best players do drive it. You know, like, so a week like last week, the reason they got bigger numbers in ratings than they did for the DP World Tour Championship is because you've got a Tommy Fleetwood, Rory McIlroy tussle down the stretch in the final group. People are turning the telly off. You don't always get that. But those top guys drive the rating. So for the guy who's 100th to expect a big piece of the pie, not really. Be grateful for the fact that you're playing for more money than you've ever played for on this tour.
It's always about the stars. I mean, I remember back at the beginning of my so-called career, I was at Golf World, the now defunct Golf World magazine in London. And whenever we wanted to bump up the simulation 1 month, we just put Seve on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all we had to do.
The power of those players, And I think those are the ones that we still rely on. But at the same time, the money has become, it's a weird thing. Money's talked about all of the time. And yet the one thing that we hear time and time again, no different when Victor Hovland won the FedEx Cup last year, is that it's not about the money. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if it's not about the money, then why have we got this money problem? That we're like, it needs to be more money. And then there's talk about, well, the majors should elevate to meet these prize funds. Like, it's enough. Like, if we lose the fact that these four major championships aren't the epitome of what makes a great versus a good,
they're in danger of making it distasteful for the public.
And the numbers that don't, that the number, they don't ring, make sense for public. You know, playing for $20 million or $25 million bucks.
I mean, I've got to work 4 or 5 months to earn that.
I know, mate. And that's working nearly all the week as well. I'm not against it. They're professional athletes. They should get paid well. They do. But there is an element also of where this is going. And obviously it's competition, right? LIV Golf comes in with the opportunity to put on these tournaments because of their financial position with the PIF. They can put these tournaments on and they're gaining a foothold in the industry. You know, this is how they're doing it.
Yeah.
It's attractive for players. I get it. And I get it why the players go and take a huge payday. I get it. Understand it. But to rival it, it's not. It doesn't really work as a business. And we're starting to see a little bit of that with some of these sponsors, like long-term big sponsors, being great for golf, you know, not necessarily renewing. Maybe things will change and they'll come back in a different way, whatever. But the price is too big for what the output is. So the eyeballs on it don't compete with football.
It's ridiculous. But I mean, Paul McGinley, again, he said this to me a couple of times, is that it's a ridiculous notion to think that people are going to pump in $20 million who am I going to get? Well, we're not quite sure.
Yeah.
You can't. That's not the answer, is it?
And I think there are, like, Rory's spoken about that recently, and that's good. I think, in essence, if you want something that's going to pump up serious dough, which big players are going to play for, however many of them it is, that you've all got to go. Yeah. You have to do that because the sponsors want that. They want you all there because then you've got a big event. And that's fine. You could build it a season around the biggest events where they all turn up. That's what they're trying to do with the signature events. But of course, it doesn't still work because the fact is there's still a problem at the moment with some of those big stars aren't playing on the PGA Tour now. Right. And John is a huge loss. I mean, let's not. It's a weird thing, isn't it? You think Cam Smith, I feel like I've sort of got used to him not being on the tour. But it's like, it's a shame. Like, he's a heck of a player. And you think about the way he won the Open, the way he won the Tour Championship, Sawgrass as well. Like, he was a fun player to watch. I miss watching him on there.
So, right. The difference with him and Ram, though, is that Cam Smith was a guy playing great golf. I'm not sure how long that was going to last. Ram's a genuinely great player.
He's potentially a standout of a generation. You know, and it's a big. The only thing you'd say is, because it was such a turn from John. I mean, you could argue there's 600 million reasons why it's a turn, but he strikes me, unless he's managed to pull the wool over our eyes for a long time, as someone who does care about winning.
Yeah,
we're like winning, being a winner, how he's thought of. That I like to think he knows more. Like that he thinks there's a definite way that I'm going to be back on that tour.
Yeah.
Before you know, it might not be this year, but I'm going to be back, and it'll all be fine.
And I hope he's right because it has to come to some conclusion. So anyway, I'm conscious of the fact that I've kept you here for an hour already, and I want to put a cap on this by following the theory of everything happens for a reason. Are you now in the place where you should be? Are you a better broadcaster than you were a player? And this is the best question. This is the role that you were destined to fill, sort of thing.
Interestingly, and it's a poison chalice, John. I'm more recognised as being a broadcaster than I was as a player, which is some ways annoys me.
On the telly, come on.
Yeah, well, I'm on all the time. I've always got the last tee time. I'm always in the last group. But because of how hard it was and how hard I worked at being a professional golfer, and I'm proud of the things I did do, part of me thinks, really? You know, because effectively, I have a passion for this game. I love golf. I love the guys that I'm at. I love travel. I love being on tour. I love being at the biggest events and being able to have the privilege of telling that story. But it's me just talking about something I love, really. I didn't go to school for it. I didn't do years and years of preparation for it.
But you've got you've got the gift of the gab, whereas my granny used to call it. And it became, I noticed that right that long ago dinner we were talking about earlier. I mean, has there ever been a moment where they've gone, right, Nick, and you've gone?
No, caught in.
No.
No, I've not.
Because I've seen it up close, and I speak as somebody who writes for a living and does this now, but it looks easy when it's done well. It's like everything else. Yeah. My God, it's hard.
I was very, you know? I was very lucky that I had someone like David Livingston to help me. He was obviously a great journalist as well. So he helped me because the questions bit was hard. Like when they first send you out there to do an interview, my first interview was Tiger Woods. I'm only used to answering. It's not, and it's a skill I still am trying to learn more and more about. And actually, I learn a lot. I'm coming into presses and finding out how you get to good questions in a concise manner.
Tell you who's very good is Tim Barter, your colleague.
Tim's brilliant. But again, journalistic brain. As much as he's a great coach as well, great journalistic brain. But it's, you know, for me, I think I am in the right place. I think it suits me more. I'm more of a team player than an individual. I think as painful as it was what I went through as a player.
You're not still, you know, blogging yourself with the what if.
No. I do. The hardest thing for me is my boy Max would desperately love to see me play a tournament. I'm just not good enough. And you know what? People say all the time when they see me do the tee time tips, because obviously film it on there. If I hit a bad one, do another one. Exactly. And that's not golf, right? Yeah. But I can still hit the shots. Like when I hit my good shots, it looks just like when I was on tour.
Yeah.
But I also hit terrible ones as well. But it doesn't matter. And I love that golf can be for me what it is for 99.999% of people. It's fun. It's hard. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's terrible. Doesn't matter. Not my job. But I would love to do that for him. And people do say, oh, you know, you should have a go again. I'm like, no.
It's not even the Dunhill Links or something?
No, because it's not even. I feel like it would be disrespectful to these guys who do this week in, week out, because I was at to be a good level to compete out here. And like it's the mental side. That card would go in that back pocket and it would all come back.
Oh yes.
And the doubts and the fear. and I love it. It's all part of the game. And I can see that with my job now, when you can see players struggling, I can empathize. And it helps me with my job of describing what's going on. But this job I do, I adore being part of a team. I see it as a real honor to tell that story, but it also allows me to turn off. When that light goes off on the camera, I am off. I don't give it a second thought. I might think, okay, that was good. That was good. That wasn't, shouldn't have asked that or whatever. 10 minutes when I'm done. And then I'm like, where are we going for dinner? I never, ever, ever did that as a professional.
I speak as a perpetual second guesser.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I knew, but soon when I played, that's what I did. I thought about it all of the time. And arguably, it was part of my own doing because I just got in my own head all of the time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't good. And if I could go, I've learned a lot from my experience across the two disciplines that would have made me a better golfer now.
Yeah.
Also, being 41 years of age, I've seen a bit more. Yeah. So I think, okay.
You've hopefully matured.
Do that. Yeah. And I think, you know, back then I couldn't get out of my own way. And, you know, golf was, I used to mark myself on, my self-esteem would correlate with the score I shot, which is a horrific way to live your life. But that's exactly as I lived because I got on tour when I was 19 through my entire 20s. So I was either up here or down here, and it's so unhealthy.
Yeah.
And then coming to terms with golf is what I do, not who I am, also unfortunately didn't mix with me being a brilliant golfer. And maybe it was too late. Maybe I'd taken so many turns in the maze with trying to find my game again. When I turned around and realized what I always had, I wanted to go back. I couldn't remember what that looked like.
A lack of realism can be a good thing in golf.
Yeah, but I think it was certainly something that it's taught me a huge amount. And you know, with this job that I do now, it's got its own pressure, and I love it. And the buzz of light TV and the counting down and the panic, and the most panicked I've felt, and talk about corpse and just to finish, which is a really nice way to finish.
Yeah.
The Ryder Cup was my first Ryder Cup. So it's the biggest thing. And in my mind, again, those habits of being a golfer, which are a bit ingrained of like, oh God. And then obviously I get the evidence on the back of it of hit it off the map, run out of golf balls like I did at one stage in my career. Like all those things come back in this job because I've got into that doubt again. I'm like, oh, Nick, and I'm uncomfortable. And I'd written myself that my weakest thing I do with what I do is I'm off the cuff. No problem. You say to me, we've got no golf, talk for an hour and a half, no problem.
Yeah.
Remembering words, big problem. Like, I'm just not good, but I write all my own stuff. So if I, and of course, David was very good at this, but when you're leading into an opener that someone's taken 2 days to make, which is Sky do a great job of, it needs the right words. And when it's the Ryder Cup, those opening words have got to be right. And we're on the first hit Whistling Straits, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, whatever, 6:30. And I've written this big long thing. It's great. I'm really happy with it. I love it. And I've learned it through the week. Great. I've learned it because I'm not good at remembering. And I got there and we had one rehearsal, literally a minute to on air. I got that in my ear on talk back and we run it. I completely forgot the words as I'm doing the rehearsal. And then I spent the last 30 seconds thinking, if that was it, this is the biggest thing you'll ever do.
Just in my sport. Your pocket, I hope.
Like that's, oh my God. Yeah. And the problem is when you corpse, you don't then find a solution. You literally just think, oh my God, you've forgotten the words. Oh my God, everyone's looking at it. And you see it all the time on TV. It's amazing. The brain paralyzes you from finding the solution.
Yeah.
And instead you just panic.
Yeah.
And I was scared. And then as I started to say it, it was amazing. That wonderful feeling like a golfer. It's like when you've been struggling, all of a sudden there's that realization of, I've got this. And it happened, and I really got into it. And it felt like I was an actor. I had always dreamt of being an actor. When I was like, I'd love to have been an actor, and I could really get into the words I was saying, and ended up being a great thing. But it is in this job, it's the thing that people fear is that what if I dry up?
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for letting us inside the last hour and a bit, Nick.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Pleasure, mate.
There are other golfers who have compelling stories, but it's unlikely that few could match Doherty for thoughtfulness and eloquence. Terrific stuff there from Huggy and Nick, and our thanks again to both for taking the time. Now, normally at this point, we play a clip from the next episode, but with the Masters just around the corner, we've got some special episodes planned for next week that haven't yet been recorded. John Huggan will be on site at Augusta National, and while we don't want to jinx anything, he has lined up some fabulous interviews, which we will be releasing virtually as they're recorded. It's going to be a big week at Augusta National, so make sure to check back here when we continue to explore the thing about golf.